But it actually, I asked ChatGPT-3 to write a joke about the topic of today. You want to hear it?
Yes.
Why did the baker with Alzheimer's keep making bread loaves shaped like question marks? Because he couldn't remember if it was supposed to be a baguette or a croissant.
Okay.
I can't laugh. It's terrible.
Yes.
Okay, let's go. The Science Basement! Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast for people who love all things science. I'm Giuliano, your host.
And I'm your co-host, Pratakshi.
And today, as ChatGPT kind of gave us a hint for, we're talking about Alzheimer's disease and possible treatment, possible ways to cure this disease. And to guide us through this topic, our guest today is Alejandra Castilla-Bolaños, a biomedical engineer from the Universidad de los Andes, Colombia, with a master in neurophysiology from the University of Regina in Canada, and currently doing a PhD in medical biophysics at the University of Toronto. Alejandra, how are you today?
Nice to meet you, and thank you for inviting me here.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. So my understanding is that your topic at the moment for your PhD is Alzheimer's disease, right? Okay, good. So we got the right person. Check. That's good. Now, obviously, I think we're all familiar with the name of the disease. We all know it has to do with aging. We know it has to do with memory. But, you know, this is your topic. You're the expert here. Can you just tell us briefly what exactly is Alzheimer's disease and what causes it?
Yeah, for sure. So as you said, yes, this is really common in seniors, but it's not part of a healthy aging. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia, and more than 45 million people suffer from this disease. Briefly, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative disease, which means that kills neurons, and it starts in the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain, which helps us to remember.
Ah, so the hippocampus is a part of our brain that helps us remember. So it's a memory-related part of the brain. And this is affected by Alzheimer's disease, right?
Yes, it is affected there. So that's why people with Alzheimer's disease cannot recall previous memories or retain new information. Alzheimer's is caused by the accumulation of toxic components in the brain. One of them is amyloid beta, and the other one is tau, a protein that gets a little fizzy and stick together, forming those toxic components that makes our neurons be killed, basically. And when these toxic components aggregate, that is causing the neurodegeneration.
Okay, so tell me if I understand correctly. So we have this part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is basically is involved in the formation of memories. And what happened is there is a toxic accumulation of these toxic proteins that somehow kill the cells of the hippocampus, so of this memory-related part.
Yeah, the thing is, we don't know how that happens. We don't know the mechanisms behind this disease. We know that happens. We know that we have this accumulation of aggregates, which are toxic for neurons, but we don't know how this disease happens in the brain.
Right. Okay.
So do we have any treatment for it now?
We don't have a cure for Alzheimer's disease, and the drugs keep failing because we don't understand the mechanisms behind the disease. So the drugs that are in the market right now are only to slow down the symptoms, but they do not treat or cure the disease because we don't know what's happening in the brain.
But Alejandra, why are the drugs not working?
I think it's because we do not have a model or an animal model that can mimic the Alzheimer's disease in preclinical studies. So we are still looking for a model that can mimic the brain tissue to treat these treatments before to go to clinical studies.
But why are animal models not good enough? We have been studying various diseases in them, right? So why are they not good enough for Alzheimer's?
That's a good point. Animal models can give us an indication of how those treatments or drugs will work in the brain. But as you know, there are some genes that are quite similar in different species. but there are some that are not identical. So we need to find a good model that can help us to understand the brain pathology before to jump and try different trials, and of course, to have a good treatment for patients with Alzheimer's disease.
So what I'm getting here is that the problem with the animal models is their brain is close to the human brain, but not close enough to represent a good model for Alzheimer's disease.
Yes, you're right. And just imagine if we can have a model that can actually mimic the human brain. And not only that, but if we can just try and get some samples from a patient to simulate that brain without taking a piece of an actual part of the brain tissue, that's what I'm working on.
What are you trying to do about it?
What I'm trying to do is just to get some part of the patient, let's say blood sample.
Mm-hmm. So blood sample from the Alzheimer's patient. So you have human patients with the disease.
Yeah. So what we are doing right now is to collect some volunteers with Alzheimer's. We're working with them, taking some blood samples to get some of their cells. And we can isolate blood cells. In this case, those are white blood cells. And we can induce them to be stem cells. And as many of you know, stem cells have the possibility to be converted in different types of cells of that individual. And because those cells are part of that patient, they have 100% of the genetic information of that patient. So when we convert those cells into stem cells, we can differentiate them into neurons, just like the neurons that are in the brain tissue of that patient. With those neurons, we can create this model that is called organoids to study Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, wait. Allow me to reorganize these ideas. So what you do is you get a patient with Alzheimer's disease, and instead of opening their heads and taking a piece of brain, which probably is not very helpful, you take a sample of their blood, and you take a specific type of cells, like white blood cells, and basically, you revert these cells to a stem cell stage. And yeah, stem cells, I think they're famous enough to be cells that can become any type of cell. So basically, cells with no identity, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
So you revert them to the stem cell phase, and then you force them to become brain cells, right?
I will say that we stimulate them to differentiate into neurons. What we do with those cells is just to treat them with nutrients and cell culture media that will get them to be differentiated into this type of cells that we want.
So it's like a special diet that you give them. And with a special diet, you convince them to become brain cells, right?
That's right.
So, and now because these cells come from the patient, obviously these brain cells will carry all the genes that led the patient to get the disease.
Yes.
And what do you do with these neurons again? You mentioned something like the organoids. What do you do with these neurons now?
Yeah, so the thing is that there are different models to study Alzheimer's disease. When you have cells and nutrients and this cell culture media with all the different components that the cells need to grow in the lab, we can create these kind of models that are called organoids. Essentially, organoids are a three-dimensional cell structure that will have the same genetic information of that patient. So it's going to mimic brain tissue from that patient. And we can grow that in the lab to develop a model from the brain tissue of that patient.
How accurate it is to say there's small brains? It's too far-fetched.
Right now, I wouldn't say that it's 100% mimicking the brain of one person, but you can think in a mini brain.
Mini brain.
It's a mini brain. And what we're doing with these cerebral organoids is just to study them, to see how we can do with them to improve the model and mimic the physiology of that patient. And going deeper, we would like to simulate the brain tissue from patients with Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
So how do you make sure that it works as a good model?
Well, to make sure that cerebral organoids are a good model to study Alzheimer's disease, and honestly, any type of disease in the brain, we should assess the organoids with different techniques, such as imaging. And one of those techniques, it's called nuclear magnetic resonance. Basically, what it does is just to study the neurochemicals inside the brain. Or in this case, if we have the organoid inside this huge equipment, we can measure the neurochemicals inside the cerebral organoid.
Okay, wait. So you have this nuclear magnetic resonance, okay, a technique that you use to study the chemicals in the brain organoids. So what's the relevance of this, of studying the chemicals? What do you look for?
As you can see, the brain has a lot of chemicals. They are always there and they have different concentrations. And this is how the brain works. Mm-hmm. Neurons communicate to each other by two different ways, a chemical way or an electrical way.
Right.
So they communicate to each other and they produce these neurochemicals. So if we have a cerebral organoid, which is a model of the brain patient, we are looking for having the same amount of neurochemicals in the brain and in the organoid.
Oh, now I see. Okay, so you make sure that the organoids, the mini brains, from the chemical point of view, behave in the same way as a real brain.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Now I got it. Cheers.
So that's what we want. We want a model that can mimic the physiology of the human brain. But to measure that, we need to make sure that we have the same concentrations and the presence of neurochemicals that we have in that brain. And the good thing of this technique is that we can compare. We can do NMR in patients because it's not an invasive technique, and we can do it in cerebral organoids.
And then you compare?
Yes.
Awesome. And how does it look? Like, does it look like these organoids are actually the same as the patient's brain? Can you tell us?
Well, that's a really good question. And that's where my thesis came out.
Aha! This is okay.
This is something that we are working on right now. I'm in my first year of PhD.
Mm-hmm.
This is my thesis proposal. We are just in a starting point in this research. Cerebral organoids are quite new. You can imagine the Nobel Prize in 2012 was because two scientists achieved this goal to reprogram cells into stem cells.
The Yamanaka factors, right?
Yeah, and this is one of the techniques that we're using to get from blood samples stem cells. And this is just coming one decade ago. So there are some research that we need to do to use those cells and then to create cerebral organoids. So this is in a starting point, I'll say. So far, we have some good samples. We are able to develop those cerebral organoids, but we're still working on how to improve the model because there are some neurochemicals that are really low in the cerebral organoid compared to the brain tissue, and there are some that are quite high. So what is this happening? We know that one of these neurochemicals is really low in the brain, and this happens when the brain is not well developed. So maybe what is happening here is that we need to have some maturation of our organoids to have better results. So this is what we're working on right now.
So at the moment, you have this kind of small issue where the organoids behave like a baby brain. Did I understand correctly, or am I just completely misunderstanding?
Yeah, no, you're right. So neurochemicals change in the brain.
As we develop, right?
Yeah, as we develop. So one of those are not the same. The concentration is not the same as a adult brain. So maybe what we are going to do as a next step in our research is to try to develop these organoids and have a maturation stage that can help us to have the amount of these neurochemicals in the same level as they are in the adult human brain.
You know what I'm imagining now, right? These sci-fi movies will have these cylinders with green water in it and brains that are just growing there. Because you're telling me now, right, that you have these mini brains that for some chemicals, or maybe one, they behave like a baby brain. And now your plan is to try to make them develop so that they resemble the adult brain. I'm just imagining these cylinders with green water in it and a brain floating, just developing. Probably that's not how it looks like.
No, this is what we have, actually.
What, really?
But not in that scale.
Is the water green?
I will say that it's smaller than you're imagining. Okay. So the diameter of a cerebral organoid is about 2 millimeters.
Oh, okay. Actually, tell us, how does it look like? Now I'm hooked. So it's a small thingy of 2 millimeters, like a small booger of neurons.
We wanted this to be really small because the cell culture media is quite expensive.
Okay.
To produce this kind of cells, to induce them in stem cells, is really expensive. So you want a model that could be handy and low cost as much as possible.
Are they in plates or in tubes?
Many of you should be familiar that scientists use Petri dishes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is what we have. But these Petri dishes are really small. So we have a well of maybe 2 centimeters of diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And we can just grow in them really small models, such as the organoids.
Oh my God. I mean, like small, tiny, 2 millimeter brains.
And you wanted that. You want to be tiny. Then you can have multiple replicates in this Petri dish.
So they don't clamp together, they stay separated.
The good thing is there are some wells in the same Petri dish. So every organoid is in one single well.
So what I've understood so far is you take blood from Alzheimer's patients or baby brains, and then you do NMR to compare it with the patients.
Yes.
So where are you right now and what is the next step in this?
Well, I will say that the next step is to make sure that we have a model that can mimic what happens in the human brain. So we already know how to develop this model of cerebral organoids, but we want to go further and try to mimic 100% of what's happening in the brain. So the next step is for sure doing the maturation, maybe changing the protocol a little bit to know how we can have a model that have the same neurochemicals that what we have in the brain. And the further steps is to induce the disease or to have a model not only to mimic the human brain, but also a brain with Alzheimer's disease.
So in the Alzheimer patients, the neurochemical concentrations, was it the same in your model as well, or was it not?
No, so far, what we have is some neurochemicals that are high or that are low compared to the adult human brain. So that's why we need to adjust the concentrations that we have in the model.
Okay, yeah, I get it now. Okay.
I have now one curiosity. So you're telling me that, of course, you get the cells from the patient and then you grow the mini brain, which will have the same genetic pool of the patient, therefore possibly also the same profile of the disease. Does that mean that once you manage to get this work 100%, does that mean that can be used to develop a personalized treatment? Because you'll be working with basically a piece of the patient's brain.
You're right. I think that this is the crucial point in this research. We need to be realistic, and maybe the model is not going to mimic 100% of the human brain. We are developing research, and this is really new, but I will say that that's our goal for sure. And the good thing is that with those volunteers that are just donating their blood for these samples, we are getting 100% of that genetic information from that patient. So we're not only mimicking the human brain, but a customized human brain from that specific patient. So you can think that this is open new opportunities, not only for tissue regeneration, but also for personalized medicine.
Amazing. I can't wait. Yeah, no, this is so cool.
So far, results that we have are just for some cell lines from patients without Alzheimer's disease. So as I told you guys, I'm just starting. So the idea is to have this model going on with samples from Alzheimer's disease. So I cannot wait either. I think this is really amazing. And the goal for me is just to help many people, more than 45 million people who are suffering from this disease. And not only people suffering from this disease, but also the caregivers, families. that are with them, and just to give some hope that we can dream and we can work for a cure for Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you so much. I think it was the best way to end it, with this kind of gift of hope that research is always going and always going forward and always trying, and one day, hopefully, we'll defeat it. Alejandra, have you watched this movie called The Father with Anthony Hopkins? It's about dealing with father with dementia. I think it's never specified that the character played by Anthony Hopkins is affected by Alzheimer's disease, but I think that's quite clear, actually. And the interesting thing is that the movie, you see it from the point of view of the father. So all the scenes are very mixed and confused, because like sometimes the same character, like the daughter, is played by two different actresses to indicate that the father is mixing up faces in his memory. So if you haven't watched it, please, actually, Alejandra, and everyone listening.
Well, I will watch it.
Am I allowed to actually advise a movie? Because we are definitely not being paid by them. I'll take responsibility for it, because I love Anthony Hopkins. And the movie is actually quite great. And, you know, if Alejandra got you passionate about the topic, as I mean, now I'm perfectly hooked on this, then please do read more about it. And Alejandra, I understand you gave a TED talk about this, didn't you?
I did a TED talk for my contributions in Alzheimer's disease in my master's. So that was in 2019. You guys can just go and check it out in YouTube. It's quite neat. But the thing is, this is not for NMR or anything about cerebral organoids. This is for the Alzheimer's disease model that we did back in 2019 in Dr. Buttigieg's lab in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. Basically, what we did is to have this module, and we measured the electrical profile of neurons. Having a good treatment, a potential treatment that can help us to understand the mechanisms behind the disease.
Okay, so we're definitely going to put the link in the description of the episode. So everyone just go and check it out. That's the first thing I'm going to do after the recording of this episode.
Thank you, Juliano.
Okay, so we're almost at the end of the episode, but it's actually, this is your moment to shine.
It's time for today's fun fact.
Oh, wow.
Guys, have you ever heard a rat giggle?
A rat giggle?
No.
No, I can't say I have.
Well, you could have if you were a tickle scientist.
Wait. What's a tickle scientist?
So a recent publication in Science showed that when in a playful mood, rats give hysterical, the word that they used was hysterical, ultrasonic giggles. So these tickle scientists tickled rats and they loved it, and they gave out ultrasonic laughter, and these scientists transposed it to a lower frequency. So you guys can go on YouTube and check it out. Those videos are super, super cute. These rats, not only do they enjoy it, they even seek it. And these scientists are trying to understand the evolutionary basis of tickleness. And they found that it encourages social animals to mingle and also point towards the joyous areas of the brain.
I have so many questions. First of all, how do you tickle a rat?
Like you tickle a human.
So the scientist just went there on the tummy of the rat and just going,
yeah.
Oh my God. Second, how did they get funding for this? No, don't get me wrong. I'm all for it. But being in the research field, it's very difficult to convince funders to fund your research. And very often you need to be working on the treatment of a disease. How did they get money to study tickling?
I mean, I can just imagine what a day in a life of a tickle scientist looks like.
Hilarious.
Who would hate Mondays, right?
Yeah, exactly. What do you do today? Oh, I'm going to tickle rats. Alejandra, what do you think of this?
My thought is, what a fun job.
I know, right? I love it. The idea was to understand the evolutionary role of being ticklish, right? And the point is that it increases
social bonding. Yeah.
Although it didn't work for me. When I was a kid or a toddler, I was very ticklish. And that means if someone tickled me, my limbs would just go crazy. And I've accidentally kicked people in face, but not on purpose, because it would be an involuntary reflex. So that would have not worked on me, but okay, cool.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know how people like it. I just don't like it.
You don't like being tickled?
No, I don't feel that that's for me. This is not giving any social bonding with me.
Well, these rats sure do like it, because when they did a pretend tickle, like they didn't actually tickle them and just did a pretend tickle, they actually seek out to, please tickle me.
You mentioned there's a video of this?
There are a lot of videos of this, yeah.
We're going to definitely put them in the description, and that's going to be the second thing I'm going to watch after this recording, which is after Alejandra's talk. It's going to be the video of the rats being tickled. Okay, that was possibly the best fun facts I've heard on this podcast. And we've been through some fun facts. Okay, but anyway, Pritakshi, thank you so much for your fun fact, for your co-hosting. And Alejandra, thank you so much for your time, your expertise, and your explanations. Best of luck for your research. Can't wait to hear more about it.
Thank you, guys. It was a pleasure to be here today with you all. And I hope we can keep in touch.
Absolutely. We really want to know more about your research. We can't wait to hear more and how it develops. And thank you to all of our listeners. That's it. This is the end of the episode. Remember to tickle rats or to enjoy being tickled. Thank you, everyone. This was the Science Basement Podcast. See you in the next episode. Bye. The Science Basement. If you liked this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate us on the podcasting app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. If you're interested in getting involved or being interviewed, get in touch at podcast@thesciencebasement.org.